I've discovered, since it was so nicely broadcast, my age today, I've discovered the whiter my hair becomes, the more ready people are to believe what I say. So that made me start to think that maybe more people would actually listen to God if they thought that he had white hair. So every word in the Bible is the word spoken by God. The Bible is the mind of God being relayed to the mind of man. And my Bible, this one has red letters in it, and I'm going to venture that a lot of you have that. So the red letters are words that Jesus spoke while he was here on earth. The black letters are words that were spoken from heaven. Actually, this is Mr. Wilson's lesson, probably within the last month. He's been talking about this particular situation with the Bible. So it stands to reason that the words that are spoken by the apostles in the New Testament are also the word of God. God has made promises to us in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 4. Peter calls those promises exceedingly great and precious. So Jesus, speaking through Paul, tells us to imitate God. This is actually my portion of scripture, is Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1. And it's virtually repeated, the same thing is repeated in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1, where we're also told by God, through Paul, to imitate Paul, because he imitates Christ. Well, imitation is the best form of flattery, after all. And now, I'm going to tell you that during my 74 years, I've witnessed a whole succession of technological revolutions. I can remember when Sputnik went in the air, you know. I can remember my grandmother and grandfather, they didn't have a telephone. It was really interesting listening to Helen talk, because she was raised in Michigan and I was raised in Oregon, but our lives weren't that different. Very, very similar situations. She was from a family larger than mine, because I only have 9, and she has like 14. Yeah. So yeah, I guess I was raised in a much smaller family. None of these technological advancements, though, has done away with the need for character in the individual or the ability to think. So let's think about this. Every story in the Bible is told as an example for us to follow. David's an example for us to follow. He was a man after God's own heart. And Moses is an example for us to follow. He was a friend of God. He was a servant of God. Nehemiah is an example. Can you guys hear me? I can really hear me now. Wow. Remember me, oh my God, for good. And that was Nehemiah's constant prayer. So the men and women of faith, and there's some mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, but not very many in the total Bible, they did hard things. So maybe we should ask ourselves, what have I done for God that was hard? Or maybe, does God even expect me to do the hard or the difficult things? And what are some examples of some hard things that Jesus did? Well, he fed 5,000 men and women and children, 5,000 men plus women and children in one day. That would be hard, and I'm not going to do that anytime soon. But I did figure it up just for my own information. I tried to think, okay, if I prepared 3 meals a day, every day, for the 54 years I've been married, that would be 59,130 meals. And sometimes I think my meals are really repetitious. And I probably haven't prepared 3 meals a day, every day, for the last 54 years. Jesus healed sick people. Now, I can give an aspirin or I can give cold medicine. Cold medicine's a little sketchy because there's a lot of instructions on cold medicine bottles. But, you know, that's kind of hard. But I know that for people like, say, Denya and Nikki, who work with sick people all the time, it's the job, and they do it. So they know how to do that. But Jesus raised people from the dead. Now, nobody else can do that, because once a person's dead, they're dead. So age actually has nothing to do with experience. Some of us, of course, are more experienced than others, but none of us is as experienced as Jesus is. We all need to have a purpose, and if we don't have a purpose, we just don't have any. We just go around in circles. We're not accomplishing anything. I'm going to read two verses that are very well-known verses to you. First is in Philippians chapter 4, verse 13. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And then the second verse is Ephesians 6, verse 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. God has a plan, and that plan is His big picture.
Sorry, I think I've tangled you up in the...
I feel like I'm in an operating room.
Glasses got tangled up in there.
Did you do this to me on purpose? You're trying to make me feel uncomfortable up here, aren't you? God uses us to carry out His plans, and His goals are going to be fulfilled with or without us. And often, I think we read stories in the Bible, but they really lack relevance to us, because we don't really actually understand the culture in the Bible and the details of that culture in that day. So I'm going to talk about one particular woman in the scriptures that is one of my favorites. Unlike Ruth, Esther was not in the direct lineage of Jesus. Esther actually was extremely brave, and she was a victim of the culture that she lived in. And us Western women of our day don't really comprehend that culture. So try to imagine living in a harem, which by definition is just an apartment reserved for females, in which anybody else is forbidden to enter. It's usually overseen by the eunuchs, and it's for the entirety of your life. You know, I'm kind of interested in the age that I have attained with God's grace, and it, what really puzzles me is how fast it got here. And the same thing is for Esther. How did Esther get to the place that she was in? Well, Esther is, her name is Hadassah. In Hebrew, it's Hadassah. And she is the heroine of the events set in the splendor of the Persian Empire at the height of its glory in the 5th century B.C. This is a tale of love and hate and palace intrigue. It's about a beautiful Jewish girl who marries King Ahasuerus. Now, during the interval between the first return of the Jews under Zerubbabel and then the second return of the Jews under Ezra to Jerusalem, or to Judea, there were incidents of far-reaching effects that were occurring in Susa, which was the wintertime capital of the Persian kings. In 486 B.C., Darius I was succeeded by his son Xerxes, who was very important in Greek history, although he was a Persian. Greek history speaks of him quite a bit because of the wars that they had. In our Bible, he's called Ahasuerus. During Ahasuerus's third year, which was before he began his wars with Greece, he made a great feast in Susa. And that feast lasted 180 days. And you guys can follow along with me in the book of Esther if you want to. I used to try to get through the story of Esther at family camp with the teenage girls, and it was really, really difficult because it's a pretty long story. So I hope I've condensed it down into a more bite-sized nugget here for you. So the account begins with a very, very sumptuous banquet in the in the palace. King Ahasuerus is in his winter palace in Susa. For all of the princes and servants, the army chiefs of Persia and Media, and the nobles and the governors of the provinces. And his purpose was to display the riches of the royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his majesty. Now, Ahasuerus had cause for pride in his winter capital. Of the three cities that served as a capital to the Persians, Susa was the finest. There was another one called Persepolis, which was 300 miles southwest of Susa. That was actually the official capital. And it was the site of the most imposing temples, and that was where the kings were buried when they died. It was occupied during the spring months. There were 127 provinces that stretched from India to Ethiopia in one direction and to the Mediterranean coast in the other. And all of the monarchs were gathered together to have this banquet with King Ahasuerus. There was a third capital also. It was called Ecbatana, which was 200 miles north, and that is where they spent their summers to get away from the heat of the other two capitals. And the Bible tells us about the opulence of the winter palace. It speaks of marble pillars and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry and marble and mother of pearl and precious stones. And it also notes that drinks were served in golden goblets. Ahasuerus reveled in the magnificence of his audience hall. There were kneeling bulls sculpted in pairs that topped the columns. The walls had glazed brick, and they were decorated with reliefs showing fantastic winged bulls and mythological creatures and Persian archers and spearmen. This is all archaeological information. Materials from every corner of the empire. There was ebony and silver from Egypt, and gold from Asia Minor. There was ivory from Ethiopia. There were semi-precious stones from the Caspian Sea. All of this was used to construct the palace. Now, Darius had brought in foreign laborers to build this palace, and they had completed the edifice with embellishments and designs from their own native lands. So outside of the royal quarters, and the royal quarters contained the palace, they contained the king's harem and the treasury. Outside of that, Susa was a very important commerce center. It was a cosmopolitan area, and you could go into Susa and you would run into Greek scientists and Jewish merchants and Persian infantrymen, and they were all together in the market-lined streets. The geographical center of what was then the largest empire ever assembled, Susa was a natural crossroads for travelers on the great highway system from Asia Minor to northern India. Now, when the Persians would conquer a kingdom, which also included Judah and Israel, they were always very lenient towards those countries, and that was sort of exceptional in those days. What they would do, they would allow the subject people to continue to worship their gods or any of the other customs that they had. And if the country had not actively fought with the Persians, then they could maintain their own form of government and they could keep their own military system, although they would have to be under Persian officers. Now, Ahasuerus saw very, very few of his multitude of subjects face to face. There was a security issue. They were always worried about security, and so he would be sitting inside the throne room, but it was separated by a curtain. The throne room itself was about 250 square feet. It was fairly large. And it had beams that held the ceiling up made out of the... I'm hearing an echo. Are you guys hearing an echo? Okay, good. It had beams made out of those famous cedars of Lebanon, the same trees that Solomon had used to build the temple. There were seven nobles that were his close advisors, and they had free access to King Ahasuerus. They could come and go without invitation. Everybody else, even family members, had to get permission to see the king. They could not enter the throne room unbidden, or they could be put to death. Only if King Ahasuerus extended his scepter towards them could they escape that punishment. Well, we'll get back to this royal reception now. This royal party, which lasted 180 days, was winding up, and on the very final day of the 180-day party, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he sent eunuchs in to bring his queen, his principal queen, Vashti, to him to show the people and the princess her beauty, for she was fair to behold. Well, amazingly, Vashti wouldn't come. And she wouldn't go because her husband was drunk, and but this was a very dangerous decision for her to make. Well, Ahasuerus was, of course, he was infuriated that she defied him that way in public. Well, his counselors, of course, had something to say about that too. They urged him to take this very drastic action and banish her, because they didn't want all the wives in the provinces to get the idea they could disobey their husbands. So he banished Vashti from his presence, and he sought a new queen. But before that happened, during the very years that followed, Ahasuerus made a trip to Greece. The wars began. He took a great navy. He was stopped in a town called Thermopylae. He was defeated in a naval battle at Salamis and nearly destroyed at Plataea. So he returned to Persia, a beaten king, and began to seek solace with his harem. Greek historians, a lot of this history comes from Greeks, from the Greeks, okay? Greek historians tell us that Ahasuerus had a very infamous wife at that time named Amestris. Amestris had 14 noble Persian youths buried alive as a thank offering to the god of the underworld. And this is the culture that we're talking about, okay? The Greek historians don't talk about Esther, and they don't mention Vashti. They do talk about two wives that Ahasuerus had. He was notably polygamous, as you can tell. So the Greeks don't talk about Vashti or Esther, and the Bible doesn't talk about the two wives that the Greeks talk about. So we have to kind of combine historical records to get the information. There was a Jew who lived in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai. He was one of the many Jews who lived in the city. When Cyrus conquered the Babylonians about 50 years earlier, he gave permission to all of the Jewish people that they could go home to Judah if they wanted to, but they had been living there for quite a while. They actually had jobs. They'd been treated well by the Babylonians, and they prospered as merchants and as craftsmen. So they really didn't have any desire to return to the dry, arid hills of Judea when they were well established in the Babylonian country. So they were free to move around, and many of them did move into Susa. Now, from the earlier Bible accounts, when we look at the Bible, we can see in the books of Ezekiel, for example, and the books of Ezra, we know that the Jewish people did cling to their Jewish faith. They were able to practice that because of the Persian tolerance to different religions and different national customs. Their day-to-day life in Susa was really not much different from the way their lives would have been in Judea. They were able to go to synagogue. The synagogue originated in Babylonia. They were able to go to the synagogue every 7 days, and also they were able to practice the Passover. So things weren't real different for them. There is evidence in the writings, in the Greek writings, that there was a man whose name was Marduk, M-A-R-D-U-K, Marduk, which is Mordecai in Hebrew. And there's evidence that a Marduk did hold a pretty high office in Susa. Well, Mordecai had a cousin, originally named Hadassah, later with Esther. Esther is a name based on Ishtar, who is a goddess of love and war. The maiden was beautiful and lovely, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter. But this was about the same time as Ahasuerus put out the command that the beautiful virgins were to be brought to the throughout the whole empire, were to be brought and to the palace, and the king was seeking a new principal wife to replace Vashti. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many maidens were gathered in Susa, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. But Mordecai, in the meantime, advised her not to reveal that she was Jewish. So the hopeful girls are all placed in a harem, where all of the royal wives and all of the royal concubines live in the harem. It's Haggai's duty to give each of these young, promising girls a whole regimen of beauty treatments. There's oils, and there's perfumes, and there's massages, and there's hairstyles. And if she wasn't already beautiful, she was absolutely gorgeous when this was all done. And then this whole process would last a year. Well, I would be so gorgeous in a year if I could just sit around and be treated that way. Even I would be gorgeous that after a year. And then after this year was over, they would be sent into the king. In the evening she went in, and in the morning she came back to the second harem in custody of a eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. And she did not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. Well, all but a few women were ever summoned by name again. This is probably, for most of them, that was the only time they saw the king. And then they lived in the harem for the rest of their lives. When Esther's turn finally came, she probably expected that was going to be the one and only time that she would be summoned to the king. But when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen. To celebrate his marriage to this girl, he gave gifts with royal liberality. And this was a very clear indication that he esteemed her. It brought joy to the people throughout the empire. Well, Mordecai was a gatekeeper at this time at the palace, and so he was able to communicate with Esther occasionally. One night he happened to overhear two of the king's doorkeepers planning to assassinate King Ahasuerus. He was able to get that information to Esther. Esther reported it. And when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And the episode was duly inscribed in the royal annals. Okay, political prisoners were not hung by the neck like in a Western movie. They would be impaled with long pointed sticks through their body in two or three places, and then the sticks would be stuck in the ground, and they would be left there to die. That's how they treated political prisoners of that day. Well, sometime later, Ahasuerus elevated a man named Haman to the highest office of what we would now call a prime minister. Now, the seven nobles, or the seven advisors that Ahasuerus relied on, had great riches and beautiful houses, and they were very, very privileged. Haman was the prime minister. He had in excess of that. He had everything that a royal person would have. And there were great shows of honor given to him, and his little wicked heart just loved that stuff. And all of the king's servants at the king's gate were to bow down and pay homage to Haman. But Mordecai would not do that. The reason Mordecai would not do that was more of a tradition than anything. In the history of the Jewish people and the Canaanites, Mordecai was of the tribe of Benjamin. Haman was an Amalekite he was from the Agag family, if you remember your history. Long, long ago, they had had a fight. There had been a battle for the possession of the land of Canaan. And now Haman, a Benjaminite, would not demean himself by bowing down to a man of the Agag family. Well, this enraged Haman, and he sought revenge, but he wasn't going to just be vengeful towards one Jewish man. He was going to be... Well, let me just read this. He sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. But he had to get permission from King Ahasuerus to perform a mass murder like this. So he had to be very cunning in how he did that. See, ever since Cyrus had began conquering the countries that he conquered, his successors had always... Their policy was to win the loyalty of the conquered countries by peaceful means rather than by violent means. So in extreme cases, they might have to crush the dissenters in some brutal way, but generally they would never do that to a whole country or to a whole people. This Haman's plan was going to go completely against Persian policy. Knowing about this, knowing that before a royal decree could be issued, the king was obligated to confer with his seven advisors. See, the king wouldn't make a decision like that without his seven advisors. Well, Haman was crafty. He managed to go around their heads. And with a combination of flattery and bribery, he approached the king. He says to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. So it is not for the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into his treasuries." Well, Ahasuerus rejected that particular bribe about the money, but he did consent to the harsher crime. He told Haman, he said, "The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." And then he gave Haman his royal signet ring, which would validate the edict. So Haman wrote the edict: to destroy, to slay, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. He'd chosen this day by casting pur, or lots, we would call it dice today, and preparations for the murder of the Jews was very, very thorough. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the people to be ready for that day. The royal couriers then carried this message to all of the provinces. They probably used a very rapid relay system. Maybe, what we would think of was the Pony Express, where the horses were just replaced and they got them there as fast as they can. They actually figured that there was an area of about 15,000 miles, and it probably took them about 2 weeks to get this message out to everybody. Now, if you were an ordinary traveler going someplace in all of that area, it would take you somewhere around 3 months to make that same journey. So you can see that they used the rapid courier system. Well, when Mordecai learned about this, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai rent his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting. Mordecai asked Queen Elizabeth. I'm thinking about this prime minister, I guess. Asked Queen Esther to intervene. He wanted her to intervene to save the people. Now, this is in the 12th year of Ahasuerus' reign. She had actually been the queen for about 5 years. But she had never told King Ahasuerus that she was Jewish. And I wonder if he had known that, if he would have allowed Haman to even begin to talk about this plan that he had. But even now, evidently, Esther kind of hesitated a little bit to disclose the fact that she was Jewish. And besides, should she approach the king without being summoned? If she did, she risked the death penalty. But Mordecai was pretty persuasive. In Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14, Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace or any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Exactly so. It's exactly so for each one of us. God's goals are going to be completed. Does he need you to get the job done? Well, no. But does he want you to get the job done? Yes. After all of the circumstances were fully understood, she was willing to die for her people. So her plan, what she told Mordecai was to go and gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do, and I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Well, at the end of that fasting period, Esther got put on her royal robes, and she made her way across the audience hall. She went down a corridor. Apparently, it wasn't that far from where the harem lived to where the 250-square-foot room was at, the throne room. And she could see, as she was making her way, she could see dozens of men waiting to present things to the king. There would be, for instance, there might be an Egyptian courier there with news about an uprising in some place in Africa or in Egypt, and he would be admitted to see the king. The seven advisors would let him go in and see the king. But there might be another man there who had brought a gift to the king. He received gifts all the time. Well, they could bring the gift, but they wouldn't get an audience with the king. And she would just walked right on in. And although she had not been called to see the king for these 30 days, she apparently just walked right past the seven advisors and proceeded into the inner court, went behind the embroidered curtain that separated him from everybody else. And when he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she found favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter. Well, she was very relieved that she got that far with him. She invited him to dinner. And she also invited Haman to come with. Ahasuerus accepted the invitation. Of course, Haman was absolutely thrilled to be able to go to have dinner with the queen. But as he left the palace, Mordecai was there, and Mordecai did not bow, and he was filled with wrath. Well, he took counsel with his family, and they said, well, maybe you should just build a gallows and hang Mordecai on those gallows. And so he did. Well, he didn't build. He couldn't hang Mordecai until he got permission from the king, but he did build the gallows. That banquet was very pleasant. It went very well. And Queen Esther invited them to dinner again the next night. Well, that night, King Ahasuerus could not sleep. And so he had some court records read to him, and one of these he came across that older entry where Mordecai had uncovered an assassination plot. What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? He asked, and he learned that absolutely nothing had been done for Mordecai. So in the morning, when Haman came to see him, the first thing the king said is, what should be done to a man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman thought right away that he was going to get some special honor. So he had a wonderful plan. He proposed that the lucky man be given royal raiment, be set on the king's horse, and led through the city square with an official crying before him, thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Well, then Haman was advised to do that for Mordecai, and he was horrified. The second banquet came. Esther dramatically exposed Haman's villainy and at last revealed her Jewish origins. And she pleaded urgently with the king, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, to be annihilated. Who would do this? Ahasuerus wanted to know. A foe and an enemy, that wicked Haman. And she points right at him, and the king gets mad and he walks out of the room. He went storming into the garden, and Haman starts to beg for his life. The king returns, sees Haman in front of the queen, and misinterprets it and says, what? Will he even assault the queen in my very, very presence, in my own house? Well, one of the people always know what's going on in the world. And there's an attendant there watching the whole thing and already knows that Haman has a gallows built. And so he just suggests, well, why don't you just hang Haman on his gallows that he's got built at his house? And so the king said, hang him. Well, this is a political prisoner. So Haman's hanging was as I described. Then his possessions were turned over to Queen Esther. And Mordecai became prime minister. Isn't this a great movie? Did you guys see the movie? But the bigger problem still has not been averted. It's not been solved. The bigger problem is the massacre of the Jews is still going to occur. It's an edict that has been signed by the king with a royal signet ring cannot be countermanded, I guess is the word to use. So his solution was to empower the Jews to defend themselves. Mordecai was given the signet ring because he is now the prime minister. His solution was to empower the Jews to go ahead and defend themselves. The decree was rushed to all the parts of the empire, and the people who received that then knew that the original edict didn't have to be rigidly enforced, but it could still be. If they wanted to kill Jews, they could. But the Jews were going to be allowed to defend themselves. In Susa, on the day set for their extermination, the Jews instead slew and destroyed 500 men. Esther pleaded for and was granted a second day of vengeance, and they slew 300 men in Susa, and in the provinces at the same time they slew 75,000 of those who hated them. And then the chronicles also say the Jewish people laid no hand on the plunder, which was what Haman wanted to do. Haman was also going to take plunder. The Jewish reprisals in self-defense took place on the 13th day of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made a day of feasting and gladness. After all of this thing happened, then Ahasuerus heavily taxed the people to start paying for his wars. I thought you needed to know that. It's kind of an American thing, isn't it? Mordecai became very great in the kingdom of Ahasuerus. His name has actually been found on clay tablets verifying his place in history. And Mordecai recorded all of the things that occurred and sent a message to all of the Jews telling them that on the 14th day of the month Adar, which is February and March in our calendar, on the 15th day of the year, they would celebrate they would have a holiday, and that holiday is called Purim, after the term Pur, which was where they cast the dice. Now, if Haman's decree had been carried out, then all of God's promises to Abraham, to Moses, to David, all the promises about the Messiah, they would have failed. But the grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of God stands forever. The Jewish people now do celebrate still the Feast of Purim. The word Purim is an Akkadian term. It's not a Hebrew term. And the feast itself really has very little relevance to the worship of God. But Purim is one of the favorite holidays of the Jewish people. And Esther is highly venerated during this celebration. But when Haman's name is mentioned, even today, there's lots of stamping and noise and hissing. What I've tried to impart to you is that Esther was one woman in a crowd of women, and she could have failed, and she could have failed in this goal, but she could have just faded into the background. She could have elected to be out on the fringe, and that was even her first impulse. But Mordecai appealed to her inner character and made her see that she could make a difference if she wanted to make a difference. You know, we might feel like we're just a little drop in the ocean. But if that drop isn't in the ocean, then the ocean is less because of that missing drop. So you're one woman with a chance to save even one person come your way. What are you going to do with the opportunity that is given to you? Now, Esther saved physical lives. And we have the opportunity to give people the opportunity for eternal life. And who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. What you're doing for God right now really does matter. Now, what happened to Esther after all of these events and how long she remained the queen is not recorded in the scriptures, but I am going to assume that she lived happily ever after.